well, this is a turn up for the books. I'm actually sat in a studio surrounded by professional gear. My voice, hello, is not very echoey at all. And the sound of traffic is in the distance. London traffic. I'm in the Guardian offices here, Guardian HQ, and I'm with Jason Phipps, who is head of audio at the Guardian. Can you explain where we're sat right now?
Well, we're in Studio 3, to be exact. I know all the listeners want those kinds of gritty details. So we're in Studio 3, and we're on the third floor in King's Place in Guardian HQ, in the Rotunde, as it is, because it's like a circular structure of the building. And we've got loads of light in this building. It's one of the most beautiful buildings I've ever worked in. There's a few quibbles I have with it, but overall, you can't complain for access to light. And anyone who's worked in audio or radio has basically usually worked in a basement or stuck in a sort of windowless room for most of their career. So for me, it's an amazing thing to have access to light. So that's where we are.
How long have you been working in audio?
Well, I've been... that's a complicated question, because professionally I've been working in audio since I became a kind of trainee at the BBC back in, the late 90s. But before that, I had a kind of haphazard career in community radio, and I worked for a kind of community station in Munich when I studied there, and I worked for a community station in Dublin when I lived there. I'm from Dublin. So I have a long association with audio and recording, and it was, I wanted to be a DJ when I was a kid, and I made cassettes and radio shows and stuff like that. So it's been a lifelong passion.
Have you seen the general public's interest in audio kind of ebb and flow over the years?
Yeah, I have, definitely. I mean, I suppose I'm a 40 plus, and my generation have definitely seen a sort of a huge shift and change. You know, I was part of the generation, I think, in the early 80s where, you know, video killed the radio star, where genuinely I think people thought maybe radio was dead, and that proved to be absolutely wrong. And then as, you get into the sort of 90s and the internet happens, people think, oh, definitely one of the media is going to die, probably radio, because the internet's going to take over everything, only for the internet to offer a kind of almost like another boon to radio. I mean, I think... before video, obviously video now is so important, but radio was a huge winner when it came to sort of global networks, and that's why podcasts evolved. They were such an obvious adjunct to blogging. I have seen that, but somehow audio and radio always seems to get stronger, always does.
When did The Guardian really embrace audio in a big way?
I think The Guardian's been a pioneer in that regard. I mean, we all know under the banner of The Guardian, Ben Hammersley sort of coined the phrase podcasts back in, I can't even remember the year now, but it was early noughties. And obviously, Ricky Gervais' podcast back in 2005, was coming up next year, would be 10 years ago, a decade, a whole decade, I think really kicked the term podcasting and the form of comedy podcasting into the mainstream. So The Guardian's, it's been very central for a very long time. And then you're sitting in the studios, so you can see the kind of, just the investment, the physical investment that The Guardian's put in to audio. I mean, it's expanded now. We're part of the multimedia department and interactives, audio slideshows, video, audio podcasts. All of these things are kind of part of a panoply of strategies to get Guardian journalism to as many people in as many ways as possible. But I mean, you're physically sitting in a place where we've got studios that are not, they're not BBC standard studios, but they're as close as I think you get to it for a kind of a non-audio radio news organisation, allegedly. I think we take it very seriously, yeah.
And I know you take it very seriously, just listening to your passion. Why audio? What does audio have that other forms of media don't?
I mean, there's the absolute cliche, which is, I think it has all of those things: intimacy, directness. I think I was saying to a colleague the other day, she's a young trainee here, and I was saying to her that you could have a quote by George Clooney about why, he so passionately loves his new bride, and you can write that down and people will read it. If you had a recording of George Clooney telling you how much he loved his new wife, it would be worth its weight in gold, because the voice tells everything. The voice is very good at sort of truthfully and directly imparting people's emotions attached to their ideas and their opinions. It's really good at that. It's very direct. So I think that's one thing why I think audio and radio is amazing. But I also think that increasingly, as we sort of move into a kind of era of screen fatigue, I think audio becomes, well, it becomes a very useful part of a kind of digital reality in society. I mean, I think there's, it was no surprise when a sort of an AI relationship was sort of envisaged in that film Her, that it was a voice that the OS was represented with. It wasn't actually a 3D image. In fact, if that film had been made sort of in the mid-90s or something, there would have been sort of a very bad 3D holograph image of an OS. I think the reason why it was audio is because actually that's the truth. I think maybe as we go forward, we'll relate to computing in a way that's based around audio. I mean, Siri is a classic model, but I'm just talking about other ways that we'll relate. The internet of things actually won't work with screens, because you couldn't possibly communicate with your fridge and your cooker and everything and your heating with data, you know, all the time flashing on screens, even on your phone, because your phone's already busy enough. But the idea that you could be told things quietly in a voice of your choosing, what's going on in your domestic environment through integrated technology, that sounds very feasible to me. I think that's probably going to happen.
I love the fact that you brought that up, because I was talking about earables and hearables and the wearable tech I would rather have at the pub not so long ago, and somebody said, have you seen the film Her? And so I immediately went out and watched the film, and I was just so pleased, because that's the closest I've seen to a vision of the future I believe we should or shouldn't be steering towards. I'd feel more comfortable with that than the distractions of visuals. I do still think that they portrayed people as kind of isolated, listening to their inner voices. And I wonder if you go, coming here to London today from a village where it's all about eye contact and morning, how are you doing, and all the rest of it, we're probably already doing that now in some ways, listening to our internal dialogues. And there is an awful lot of headphones on the streets right now.
Yeah, I mean, now if we hear a conversation in the street, we're almost surprised if it's somebody actually talking to somebody and it's not on a phone. There is that odd dislocation of kind of everyday street conversations. That's the truth. Yeah, it's not, I'm not saying it's all positive. I'm just saying that it's a reality. Like, it makes sense, just because we just can't stare at screens 24/7. We just can't do it. I mean, I myself, I'm sure you're the same. I just wonder how long my eyesight will keep up. And I do note that, you know, I stare at a computer a lot. I edit video, I edit audio. And then I go home and I mean, I turn on a screen and I watch TV, and, you know, maybe I read a book, maybe, you know. But I think increasingly maybe I won't do that. I think audio will become even more important for me, I think.
So do you get much of a chance now to listen to audio in amongst all of the work-related audio you are editing and playing with, in a professional manner?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I mean, I cycle to work, and I think that's my kind of listening time. I know that's probably not great safety-wise, but it is that like 40 minutes where I can listen to stuff. And I mean, I'm a total kind of Radiohead. I'm a mild insomniac, so I listen to stuff at night. I hate silence. I'm starting to sort of get into therapy now. I do have a sort of slight fear of tinnitus, whatever. So I tend to block things out, and I listen to things a lot. And also, just because in the last 10 years, podcasting has opened up a world of amazing audio, amazing stories, amazing characters. You know, it's not that America sort of dominates here, but America is obviously a really, really interesting, rich podcast culture. Because of the nature of National Public Radio in America, there's an inherent sort of independence in it. So there's a great diversity of voices. It's great to hear that diversity. We sometimes have a monolithic idea of American culture, and podcasting breaks that up, and you get to see there's loads of these kind of different cultures. So I listen fairly widely. I'm a German speaker, so I listen to a lot of German stuff, which is great. I mean, we can now have access to any radio, any audio stream, you know, through apps. It's incredible when you think about it. You know, if we'd sat down, I don't know, even maybe 10, 15 years ago, and we said, oh, there will, you know, on, you'll have a little device, you'll hold it in your hand, and you'll have a little app, a little thing, and you'll open it up, and you can go to any live radio stream around the world and listen to it. You know, you can navigate to a community station in Berlin called Herbst FM, and you can listen to sort of sonic radio works at 2 o'clock in the morning. You know, that would have been magic. It is magic.
Have you heard of Radio Helsinki?
I haven't heard of it. I mean, no.
I see a sticker every time I go to the festival I'm going to in a few weeks called the Elevate Festival in Graz. Radio Helsinki everywhere. And I it's this kind of weird underground internet stroke. I believe it's pirate in certain areas radio station. I can't wait to check it out. And I keep forgetting. I keep wanting to check it out. I'm just going to Google it and I bet you there's a webpage. But for me, it does excite me to see these people continuing to champion. And have you seen drone radio?
No, I
radio
haven't.
Radio based on drones.
You're showing me up for the...
No, well, it's actually... I think it's a project that's not mainstream as yet. But picture this. Putting a pirate radio station on a drone and just letting it go.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. I mean, to be honest with you, Resonance in London, it also has a, you know, big international audience of streams. And in fact, I'll give you a sort of a strange moment how radio and audio through the internet creates this other connected world. I used to do a jazz program with a great journalist called Kevin Legendre. We did a program called Now's the Time. And we went out on Resonance, and I knew a guy in World Service who was Polish, and he used to do these kind of dub sort of nights back in Poland. And he said he was in somewhere like the suburbs of Warsaw at this kind of strange nightclub. And they had a chill-out room. He was doing, obviously, a dub set, and there was electronic music, and they had a chill-out room. And he went in, and he was listening, and there was this beautiful jazz tune on, and he was thinking, oh, this is great, I have to tell Jason about this. I wonder who this is. And then suddenly my voice came on over the stream, and he thought he was tripping. And he went up to the guy and he was like, what is that? And they said, yeah, we've got it on Resonance. We were listening to the live stream of Resonance. That was on some sort of loop late at night. And you just think, that is incredible in a way. You know what I mean? That something so seemingly niche and obscure travels out through these networks and ends up entertaining people in chill-out rooms and clubs in sort of like the suburbs of Warsaw. That's thrilling in a way.
Do you, like me, find yourself getting more emotional at audio than you do at video? Because you mentioned American podcasting and American audio programs a moment ago. I don't think I've ever cried more to content coming through my device than to things like This American Life, which I know is hugely popular now, but also Radiolab, Snap Judgment.
Yeah, Love and Radio. It's
I'm mostly in the car on my own rather than walking down a road, but I was in a traffic jam once and somebody was looking over and I realised that like tears are streaming from my eyes, and that just doesn't happen with video. I don't know why, for me.
Yeah, it doesn't. I don't, you know, and I think there's a really interesting new podcast out called Death, Sex and Money, I think it is, Anna Sale on NPR. I might have those words mixed up. Anyway, I think it's only about maybe 10 episodes in, but it's one of the first episodes is with Jane Fonda, and you think you've heard every interview with Jane. I mean, she's an interesting character, she's an amazing character, but you think you've heard every interview, right, you know. And listen to that, and it's one of the best interviews I've ever heard. And it's Fonda comes across as an incredibly interesting, vulnerable, complex character that you can't, you know, it's no offense, but there's very few videos or TV shows that can capture people like that. I mean, that's why This American Life is so amazing, because actually TV is really bad at telling very interesting, complex stories. It's bad at it really is. And then because we're visual and we've got so much prejudice about how people look, and you know, audio allows us to understand somebody before we judge somebody. I think that's my fundamental sort of, that is the fundamental power of it. I think when we listen, we get to maybe the essence of who somebody is before we say, before we write them off or write them up, you know, or I think they're great, whatever. We're not enamored or we're not too judgmental. It's some sort of middle ground. Anyway, that's my COD theory on it.
I thought you were going to touch upon the theatre of the mind aspect. Mm. Can you explain what that means?
Well, I mean, this, the idea that, you know, inherently our brains are, we're more visual with audio than we are. I mean, I think that is actually true. I think that's the reason why novels work in some sense, that, you know, we can create far more elaborate and interesting visuals when we're not given visual stimulus. We're not told. It's not prescribed. And audio does something strange. It gives us senses of space. I mean, it gives us enough so our imagination, our visual imagination, can really engage with something and be playful with it. But it also locates us in spaces because of the ambience of the sounds. We feel we're more closer to some sort of like imaginative space or architecture. We can locate things in that. I mean, that's my theory of it. I work like that. I mean, I am very visual. Mm. I study visual art, actually. I didn't study any kind of acoustic art, or I study visual art. And one of the reasons why I started to work in radio, or it was because I needed a way to be visual and not look at things in a way. That's I was, and I started to make programs with interviews with artists, and I basically tried to do a very bad version of a brilliant, brilliant audio magazine that was published by an artist called Bill Furlong here in the UK over a period of about 20 years, called Audio Arts. You used to be able to buy it on cassettes in like the ICA or decent contemporary art spaces. And he did these kind of elongated, very dry, very similar interviews to the one that you're doing with me now about visual art. And for some reason, you know, you could read a million contemporary art magazines about artists, with interviews with artists, and you never got half the nuance, the kind of richness, the complexity, the emotion behind work, than going and listening to Bill Furlong or one of the people in audio arts talk to contemporary artists. It could have been Anthony Gormley or Jeff Wall or, you know, any of these people. How they spoke about their work said so much about what the work really meant, and it made you understand it visually in some sense. So anyway, that was the reason why I think that theatre of the mind, I think it's absolutely true, and you can be very, you know, I'm being slightly waffly about it, but I think it is true.
What fascinates me is I've been doing an experiment the past week or so, not a massive experiment, being only a week long, and I've been sitting with my 5-year-old boy and my nearly 3-year-old girl, and when we read books, they're constantly distracted. Not many words on a page. They've seen the picture, wandering off, looking somewhere else. When I tell them a story without any visual aids, they're staring at my face, totally engrossed with what might happen next. And yet when I say to them, can you picture that in your mind? My little boy will say, no. I'll go, well, what do you think he looks like? And he'll explain it brilliantly, a description I gave. So this deep attraction to tablets and the screens that I have around the house, in some ways is, I guess, confusing my little boy to not know that you can picture in your mind to that kind of depth. And I see him so much more engrossed when I tell a story without pictures, that I'm just putting some of the not so amazing books away and actually reading either books that have no pictures or just making it up as I go along. This theatre of the mind for me, constantly fascinating. So I was going to ask you to sign off our conversation with some kind of jingle that you think would be suitable. But before you do that, you're going to have to make it up, by the way. I don't know how musical you are. Point people to some part of the Guardian audio empire that you're really happy about, really chuffed with, and you think might inspire?
Well, I mean, so I have a new job as head of audio, which means I'm responsible for all of the audio content, and the fact that we're going to expand. We will be doing more audio in the future, and we're also going to expand in the States because we've got a New York office and we haven't really focused on audio there, and we all know that it's huge in the States. I mean, so I produce Tech Weekly and Science Weekly, and both podcasts I love dearly. What would I point? I would definitely say if you...
Look, in fact, you're smiling. I can't choose.
I can't choose. It's like between children or whatever, isn't it? This is terrible. What I would point you towards is... I think what we have done in science, specifically what we did very well over the last couple of years, is those long format interviews with seriously good thinkers and scientists around really cutting edge work. Everything from, you know, in the area of biology and sort of cosmology, in computing. If you really want to sort of get sort of real meat, the meat of an argument around big issues in science, I'd encourage you to subscribe to Science Weekly. Alok Jha, who's not with us anymore, was a great interviewer, so great. ITN stole him, which is fair enough. We wish him well. But Ian Sample is definitely his equal, is a great interviewer, and we're very fortunate that we've got great writers, but also great emerging broadcasters within The Guardian. So, I mean, the BBC have got their act together in the last couple of years around science. You can see them; they're really working hard. But we were there before they were, and I think if you want to see some, or you want to experience some really great first person interviews with cutting edge scientists, I'd point you towards Science Weekly. That's what I'm saying. It's a waffly way of saying, if you want to be clever, go and download Science Weekly.
Jason Phipps, thank you very much indeed.
You're welcome. I have to come up with the jingle. I don't know.
I'll start it off.
@JSO tweet.